The Where Our Minds Wander podcast may contain sensitive content. Listener discretion is advised.
Greetings, fellow wanderers, to the places our minds wander.
The house at the end of the dirt road, where disembodied voices whisper and strange sounds make the living shiver.
Where shadows lurk at the edge of the woods, just outside your back door. And mysterious lights speed beyond reason across the clear night sky.
Odd events throughout time that lead you down the rabbit hole.
I'm Wes.
And I'm Beth.
And this is Where Our Minds Wander. Hello and welcome to Where Our Minds Wander, all you fellow wanderers. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, hello everybody and welcome.
For those of you who follow us on Facebook, we have a new admin on our Facebook page, Mr. Johnny Walsh, a retired editor from New York City, and he's also our neighbor. And by the way, he's the voice of our listener content warning, and he's going to be helping us out posting interesting pieces on our Facebook page. Because Beth and I don't always have the time to post as much as we'd like to, so he's going to be helping us out.
Yeah, so if you've noticed an uptick in postings lately, it's probably Johnny. And if you don't follow us on Facebook, you should go check it out.
So, Beth, we're not going to do any housekeeping tonight. So, do you want to get us started off tonight and tell everyone where your mind wandered for this episode?
Okay, so I'd like to tell you the story of Utsuro Bune. It began on February 22, 1803, on the Harayadori coast of the Hitachi Prefecture in eastern Japan. Local fishermen, preparing for their daily catch, happened to notice a strange boat in the distance. They watched it as the Pacific Ocean's current slowly brought it closer to them, and as they saw that it was never going to make it to land, they tied a thick rope between their boats and this very odd vessel and towed it safely to shore. The 11 feet high by almost 18 feet wide vessel was very, very strange. The fishermen said it was shaped like an incense burner, so very round with a domed top. The bottom half was made of a shiny metal. The top half was constructed out of brightly lacquered rosewood, filled with glass-paned windows. On the outside, the windows were protected by metal bars. It looked nothing like their wooden fishing boats. In fact, it looked very much like what we'd call a UFO. Once on shore, the curious fishermen peered inside, where they could see strange unknown writing all over the walls. One of the symbols closely resembled the modern-day Korean flag. There was no furniture, just two bedsheets, a bottle of water, and some cake and kneaded meat. And then they noticed the young woman hiding inside. She was between the ages of 18 and 20, and she was rather short, just under 5 feet tall. That in itself was rather startling, to find a lone woman floating along in this strange ship. But her appearance truly baffled them. Her eyebrows and hair were red, but her hair ended in some sort of white added-on extensions, like some sort of animal fur. Her skin was pale pink, and her clothes were made out of some strangely smooth fabric unlike any they had ever seen before. She emerged from the ship and spoke to them in an unknown language. She seemed kind and very polite, but no matter how they tried, they couldn't communicate. And in some ways, she did behave a little strangely. The entire time they interacted with her, she clutched a pale box about 24 inches wide in her hands. She would not let them touch it or take it from her. She was unable or unwilling to even try to communicate what was inside. Intrigued, they brought her into town. It isn't clear how long she stayed, but communicating with her seemed completely impossible. And so the townspeople became afraid of her, especially when an elder in the village speculated that she carried the head of a dead lover in the box. He said that perhaps she was a princess from a faraway land who was accused of adultery. Her lover was beheaded, as he should have been, but she had fled her punishment in this fantastical boat, doomed to carry his head for all eternity. Now, that was enough to convince the townsfolk that the woman needed to be returned to her Utsuro Bune, which means hollow boat, and pushed back into the sea. Afraid to investigate further, that's exactly what they did. The foreign woman floated away on the sea, never to be seen again. So what do you think?
I don't know what to think. I mean, it sounds like a modern ship, because it's made out of rosewood.
And lots of metal.
Yeah.
And it was round.
And they didn't even investigate further. I mean, they made up this whole story and sat, you know, just sent her back out to sea.
They were afraid of her.
I know, but you'd think somebody would have looked inside the box.
Well, yeah. Wrestled it from her and...
Right.
Yeah. And it was 1803.
That's true.
So, yeah.
It was a while ago.
Now, there's another version of the story which is slightly different. In the second version, the date is March 24th, 1803, and the top of the craft was painted black. There were four barred windows, and the bottom half was covered in metal, most surely made out of iron. Although the color of her hair isn't mentioned in this second version, it is described as very smooth and loosely flowing down her back. And instead of bed sheets inside the boat, it was luxurious carpets like no one had ever seen before. And there was also a cup decorated in strange ornaments. So the story has a few small details changed, but it's not the only account of a Utsuro Bune, or hollow boat, floating to shore in Japan. There's also an account from May 11th of 1698, and an even earlier one from the 7th century. This one also involves a fisherman, and the young woman inside the round hollow boat is a 13-year-old girl. She was able to communicate and told the fisherman that she had escaped from an evil stepmother in India and had taken her chances on the sea. She presented him with cocoons to show that she came from far away, and legend has it that's how silkworms first came to Japan. So that last one is most likely pure legend or folktale, and I won't try to tell you that it's not. But the Utsuro Bune story from 1803, well, that one has some stuff about it that I think we should look at a little bit. For starters, there are 11 different documents, including four literary texts, the Oshuku Zaki from 1815, the Toen Shosetsu from 1825, the Hyōkyū Kishū from 1835, and the Ume no Chiri from 1844. Now, the Ume no Chiri is the second version I shared, the one where she has flowing hair and the top half of the boat is painted black. Well, what's interesting about all of these documents, according to expert and professor Tanaka Kazuo, is that all of the documents include drawings of the Utsuro Bune itself. and they're all from the early to mid-1800s, and they all look like classic UFOs. He also points out that the 1803 account is special because it has a known date and a location. The Hitachi Prefecture did exist. It was a real place, although today it's called the Ibaraki Prefecture. According to the Nippon.com article Itsuro Bune, a UFO legend from 19th century Japan, published in 2020, Kazuo believes that the encounter really did happen, but he's not convinced it was a UFO encounter. He speculates that the craft could have been part of a broken-up Russian vessel, which would explain the woman's red hair and her unknown language. But it's kind of hard to look at the illustrations from the stories written in the 1800s and see a broken-up Russian vessel. It's much easier, frankly, to see a UFO, because that truly is what it looks like. You could argue that one illustrator simply copied the ideas of an earlier publication, but the illustrators relied on the description of the craft from the tales pretty closely. Does it look like a UFO to you in the pictures?
And it kind of looks like one of those, like an upside down spinning top that we had when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd push the handle down, it'd wind it up, and it would just spin, take off.
Oh, yeah, those big metal ones.
Yes.
Yeah, it does without the handle part on the top.
Right.
Well, whether the Utsuro Bune was a UFO or not, historically, the Japanese government has been pretty decisive on the subject of UFOs. They have flat out said for decades that they absolutely do not exist. And they've said it with downright conviction. So much so that if you look at any list of worldwide alleged sightings over the last 100 years or so, Japan is commonly only listed once for the Utsuro Bune incident of 1803. Recently, that's begun to change a little, though, and UFO sightings are starting to be taken with a little more open-mindedness. For example, there is the 1986 Japan Airlines cargo plane encounter that we covered in episode 30. It's possible that this encounter is a little more well-known because it occurred over Alaska and not Japan itself. Back in 2009, the former prime minister's wife received some flack when she wrote in a book that she believed she'd had an alien encounter in the 1980s. She claimed that while she was sleeping, her soul was transported onto a triangular UFO that brought her to Venus. Her husband famously told her that she was just dreaming. But other sightings with multiple witnesses have barely registered a sentence or two in the media, quickly being stamped out by the Japanese government. For example, in January of 2014, dozens of people witnessed mysterious lights over Okinawa. Then in July of 2015, 10 white globes were seen floating above Osaka. And in November of 2016, there was a flashing green orb spotted in Niigata on the western coast of Honshu Island. But perhaps the International UFO Lab in Fukushima will change that. It's certainly gotten a lot of attention from our government in the last couple of years, especially since the lab has collected over 400 sightings in just the last 3 years alone, although they claim the nuclear reactor disaster 13 years ago is what brings the alien crafts to their corner of the world. Now, it's kind of a weird aside, but I kind of had a Mandela effect when I was researching this story, because the Fukushima disaster happened in 2011. And I could have sworn that you and I were together when that happened.
Right.
But we weren't together until 2016.
Yeah, so, it was a little while after.
Yeah. But to me, I always just thought that it was more recent than that. So I did have kind of a little Mandela effect, like maybe it only happened 5 years ago kind of thing. Anyway, according to the Mirror, the Inomachi district of Fukushima is pretty small. Just 5,000 people live there. But many people credit the lack of nighttime lights for people's abilities to spot anomalies in the sky. The International UFO Lab is housed in a former amusement hall built on the side of Sengenmori Mountain. Now, Sengenmori Mountain has been an anomaly itself for centuries, and it certainly has had its fair share of legends and stories told about it. Today, some people believe that the 1,515-foot-tall mountain possesses a strong magnetic field, and it is a known fact that compass needles go a little wonky when people are on the mountain. Some also believe that several of the natural rock formations on the mountain all point in the same direction for a reason, that together these things act as a sort of beacon for alien visitors. People certainly thought so back in 1972, when a cone-shaped object that emitted a bright white light hovered over the mountain. It would fly sideways, hover, then fly back over to where it started and hover before it just vanished out of the sky. The International UFO Lab opened in June of 2021. The director is Takaharu Mikami, who's also the editor-in-chief of Moo Magazine, which we've mentioned in other episodes. Initially, they housed 935 declassified CIA documents pertaining to UAPs seen worldwide, but they very quickly began compiling sightings from much closer to home. The majority of sightings are very similar. A white, silver, or translucent craft between 3 and 12 feet wide was seen hovering between 10 and 30,000 feet from the ground. There's no exhaust, and when the hovering object takes off, it can reach speeds of Mach 2, or 1,534.5 miles per hour. And according to an article published by the Japan News, out of the 452 reports the lab has received just in 2022 alone, 149 of them were deemed completely authentic, including 125 photographs and 24 video clips showing confirmed UFOs, or UAPs, if you prefer the new term. Four of those items were made public in Japan, like a black oval object that was photographed in September 2018 over the Tateyama mountain range in Toyama Prefecture. The black object appears in just one photo in a series of shots taken one after another by the photographer. A second photo that was made public was taken in August of 2021 by a visiting first grader. The child captured a classic saucer-like craft directly over the peak of Sengenmori Mountain. The funny thing is, our government has been compiling UFO reports in and around the Fukushima region of Japan since 1996, according to a New York Post article. And in the recently released Department of Defense Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, or UAP, reporting system, they've identified southern Japan as a hotspot. Interestingly, the specific hotspot areas are Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and now Fukushima. which are all sites of nuclear activity. The article goes on to say that for the last 4 years, the Japanese military has been instructed to take photos and detailed notes about anything unusual they see in the sky. And the Japanese government has formulated protocols for what to do in the event of a UFO interaction. Although their protocols are simply the exact same ones they have for intercepting or dealing with any foreign aircraft. At least, this was true as of 2021. It may have changed since then. So they gave in and came up with some protocols, but they're exactly the same as if they were dealing with, you know, any foreign aircraft in their airspace, which is kind of funny. Well, we'll write them, but... So, in some ways, the Japanese officials are slowly coming around to the idea of the existence of UFOs, or at least acknowledging them publicly. There are still the holdouts that vehemently deny their existence, which is fine, you know, to each their own. But whether the Utsuro Bune legend is based on any truth, or whether it was entirely made up, that will probably always remain a mystery.
You know, dear, now that you mention it, you really don't hear too much on any UFO stories coming out of Japan.
No, you really don't. And I mean, we look at the airline pilot from the cargo plane from 1986, the one that we had covered in that other episode.
Yes.
And they fired him because he spoke out about what he had seen, you know, and they made all kinds of jokes about it. The media did and the, you know, government officials did. Not jokes about firing him, but jokes about what the aliens were after, supposedly.
Right. Well, that's happening all over, though. That did happen all over. You know, at one time, it was all a big joke.
Right.
But now the media is starting to take it seriously, especially since now pilots are encouraged to come forth and talk about their experiences, to turn in what they've seen. Before, well, it was pretty much a good way to get grounded.
Right, and I'm really hoping that this international UFO lab will really contribute to the study of UAPs and what exactly is going on in the sky.
Yeah, it's certainly a first step.
It's another eye on the sky, which
That's
I think we need.
And, you know, I can remember when Fukushima happened. I watched it all the time on TV. I couldn't get enough of it. It was just devastating. But amazing. And, you know, now that you think about it, why wouldn't they, you know, UFOs, UAPs be interested in these sites in Japan? Because we know that in the U.S., they're known to be seen over nuclear facilities. So why wouldn't they want to investigate these nuclear mishaps
that have
in Japan.
Yep.
It just seems reasonable.
Well, yeah, it follows the narrative of what we think we know about UFOs.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was definitely an interesting story, dear.
Well, thank you.
And we'll be right back after this quick break.
Hey, did you know? We found you some random facts about animals to make you smile.
Sea otters hold hands while they sleep, so they don't drift apart.
Mice and rats are ticklish and will laugh if you tickle them.
Shaved guinea pigs look exactly like baby hippos.
Goats have accents just like people.
A group of hedgehogs is called a prickle.
Cows produce more milk while listening to REM's Everybody Hurts.
Crows play pranks on each other.
And wild Japanese macaques not only make snowballs for fun, they also use coins to get snacks from vending machines. Who'da thunk it?
All right, we're back.
I'm going to go find me a rat so I can tickle it and see if it laughs.
That would be strange.
Like I would get close enough to a rat to try to tickle it.
I can't believe hedgehogs, a group of them, is called a prickle.
I know. That's a perfect name for them. It made me giggle the first time you said it, and we had to edit it out.
Now I could see porcupines.
Right. Maybe they're porkles.
Maybe, perhaps so. Porkles.
Porkles. All right. So what are you talking about tonight?
Well, tonight I'm talking about the Moon-Eyed People.
Oh, cool. All right. I'm looking forward to this.
In 1841, farmer Felix Ashley had just purchased 6 acres of land in North Carolina. As he readied his field for planting, he unearthed something that intrigued him, a stone statue depicting 2 humanoid figures. They were strange. They were armless, and their oval-shaped faces narrowed into pointy chins. Their noses were long, their mouths just a slit. But it was their eyes, deep set and round, that were really unique. He put the statue on a sled and brought it back to his homestead, where he leaned it up against his well house. The statue, which has been on display at the Cherokee County Historical Museum in Murphy, North Carolina, since 2015, stands 3 feet tall. It depicts 2 conjoined humanoid figures, or 2 figures that are standing very close together. Made out of block soapstone, which was pecked with a harder stone, the 2 figures have no distinguishing anatomical features or appendages, like arms. But what they do have are very oval-shaped concave heads and eyes that are too big for their faces. At first glance, it's easy to call them alien-looking, as in extraterrestrial, not from this planet, and plenty of people have. Known for many years as the Moon-Eyed People statue, the stone carving is as intriguing as the legend about the Moon-Eyed People. Although it's only been on display at the museum since 2015, plenty of experts have weighed in on what the statue could represent. Some say they are simply a humanoid representation of 2 conjoining rivers. And then there are those who wonder if the Moon-Eyed People statue is meant to represent the Melungeons, descendants of Welsh explorers and adventurers who may have arrived in Alabama as long ago as 1170 AD. So that's a while ago.
A long time ago.
And as I said, there are those who adamantly think that the Moon-Eyed People were aliens. But one thing is for certain. Stories about them have existed for centuries, and there are some compelling theories that they were once very real. According to NorthCarolinaGhost.com, the stories of the Moon-Eyed People began with the Cherokee, who migrated in the southern Appalachians in the present-day states of North Carolina and Georgia. They told stories for centuries about a race of small, pale-skinned men, possibly albino, with beards and pale blue eyes. Their eyes were so pale that they struggled to see in any kind of bright light, like sunlight, so they were strictly nocturnal. When the Cherokee encountered them, they wanted very much to expel them from the land. Knowing the invading Cherokee were coming, the Moon-Eyed People constructed a defense wall. This stone wall was 12 feet wide and stood 4 feet high in some sections. The Cherokee waited until a night with a full moon, knowing that the Moon-Eyed People wouldn't see very well. Although impressive, the wall was no match for the Cherokee, especially in the moonlight, and the war between them was easily won by the Cherokee. Defeated, the Moon-Eyed People retreated to caverns underground, where they avoided the sunlight and their enemies. Eventually, the Cherokee were able to run them out completely. Now, fast forward to 1782 and the arrival of frontiersman John Sevier. Making his way through Georgia, Sevier came upon a man-made structure on top of a mountain. According to the archaeologist.org, It was an impressive military-like structure covering 100 acres. It was surrounded by a stone wall, 12 feet wide, and anywhere from 2 to 4 feet tall. It was 850 feet long. So that's a big wall.
It was massive.
Sevier was intrigued, and so he asked Cherokee Chief Akonostota what he knew about it. The chief, who was 90 years old at the time, told Sevier that the fort was built by the Moon-Eyed people, a race of pale-skinned, blue-eyed people from across the Great Water. They lived in circular-shaped homes made from upright logs. They had been there for a very long time before the Cherokee had arrived. Ironically, it was Sevier who later became governor of Tennessee and played a major part in expelling the Cherokee from their lands between 1800 and 1805. The next documentation about the Moon-Eyed people is from 1797. American botanist, naturalist, and physician Benjamin Smith Barton wrote about the Moon-Eyed people in his book, New Views of the Origins of the Tribes and Nations of America. Barton was a firm believer that the mound builders were in fact Native Americans, and that the mounds were much older than his peers said they were. He also served as a mentor of sorts to Meriwether Lewis before Lewis and Clark set out on their exploration of the Louisiana Territory in 1803.
That's cool.
It's very cool.
He was like, you know, he could name drop.
That he could. But anyways, he wrote in his book that Colonel Leonard Marbury, who was an intermediary between the Cherokee and the U.S. government, said, quote, "The Cherokee tell us that when they first arrived in the country, which they inhabit, they found it possessed by certain moon-eyed people who could not see by daytime. These wretches, they expelled," end quote. Barton went on to speculate that these moon-eyed people were descendants of a race of albinos. He cited a similar case in Panama, where a Welsh explorer named Lionel Wafer encountered an albino people who also struggled to see during the daytime, and they were nocturnal because of it. Over the centuries, there were other references to the moon-eyed people in books and letters. But let's double back to that stone fort Sevier found in 1782. There are, in fact, several man-made stone structures all along the Appalachians attributed to ancient cultures. Fort Mountain, Georgia? Well, that's the one that Sevier came across. Dated to 400 to 500 CE, the stone wall is just beyond the North Carolina border. Today, it's part of the Fort Mountain State Park. The wall, which spans 850 feet along the mountain ridge, is 12 feet wide and stands anywhere from 2 to 6 feet tall. It looks very similar to European-style fortifications from that time period, which is interesting since Sevier once told a friend that the wall had been built by the Welsh. He even said that they were constructed in order to stave off the Cherokee, but that they lost and were driven off. So, were the Moon-Eyed people really Welshmen? Sevier seemed to think so. But is that even possible? Well, I guess apparently so. There are some experts who believe that the Moon-Eyed people tale is really one of the Cherokee ancestors coming into contact with Welsh explorers who arrived in the New World hundreds of years before Columbus. Although it's also considered a legend, the story of Prince Madoc of Wales kind of matches up, or at least some experts think so. In 1170, Prince Madoc and his brother Rhyrid were tired of civil war raging on in their country, and so they gathered a few followers and sailed for new lands. They crossed the Atlantic Ocean and landed in what is now Mobile Bay, Alabama. Madoc liked it so much that he returned to Wales and filled 10 ships with more followers. And when he returned to the New World, these men and women set up colonies along the Appalachians. They settled in with their Native American neighbors and assimilated parts of the indigenous culture into their own. Chief Akonostota told Sevier back in 1782 that he believed the mounds all throughout the area were actually constructed by the Welsh. Even earlier, in 1608, as more Welsh settlers arrived in the area, they were surprised by how familiar at least one of the native tribes' languages sounded. In fact, by speaking Welsh, they were able to communicate quite well. They also recognized several of the stone structures along the Appalachians as Welsh, or at least European in design, and were surprised that the native cultures had such a similar building style to theirs. They also noted that some native people had pale skin and blue eyes. As noted by StrangeCarolinas.com, if you fast forward to 1803, when Thomas Jefferson was setting up the Corps of Discovery to explore the Louisiana Territory and writing policy that would eventually displace the Native American people to west of the Mississippi, he referred to them as Welsh Indians. Interestingly, so did Lewis and Clark in their journals.
I've never heard of that before. That's really compelling. That's interesting. I wonder why they called them Welsh Indians unless they thought
they were Welsh.
That they were Welsh, that they were from Wales originally.
So, if the Moon-Eyed people were really Welshmen, where did they go after the Cherokee forced them out? According to NorthCarolinaGhost.com, they likely fled to South Florida and Alabama, where they continued to carry on traditions that were both Welsh and Native American mixed together.
Huh.
Very interesting, isn't
it? That is interesting.
Now, there's a lot of controversy over the Prince Madoc legend, especially since the wall at Fort Mountain predates his alleged arrival by at least 200 years.
Oh.
Yes.
I hate it when you lead me down one way and then you burst the bubble.
That's what I do, baby. And there hasn't been any conclusive evidence to support that hundreds of Welshmen arrived in the New World before Columbus. There are those, however, who argue strongly for it and against it, but so far, there's been nothing that's indisputable. Now, some experts argue that by turning the Moon-Eyed People legend into a white European settler thing, we're just trying to find one more way of taking over a Native American legend and making it about us. There are some experts who have looked back at Sevier's journals and letters and argue that he never said that they were white. He said they were pale-skinned, which doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. But if we go back to the Cherokee County Historical Museum and take a look at the Moon-Eyed People statue, I have to add that there are two more entirely different possibilities. First, there's the idea that the Moon-Eyed people were ancient aliens. Due to the shape of their faces and big eyes, it's true that visitors to the museum often say that they look alien. Plus, their height is just 3 feet. So they were tiny.
Right.
But for this episode, I won't go into detail about that, other than to say that the ancient alien supporters point out that they did live underground for some time and that they were possibly reptilian. But we can leave that theory for another episode, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I do find the reptilian fascinating.
Right.
But when I look at the Moon-Eyed people, I don't see reptilian.
No. They look more like grays than reptilians.
They do. Finally, there are some people who don't think the statue depicts Moon-Eyed people at all. They think that the statue is really a representation of a completely different Cherokee legend, that of the Little People. According to legend, the Little People of Appalachia are similar to fairies in Europe. They were a small race of beings who loved singing, dancing, and drumming. Sometimes their drums could be heard in the mountains, and it was important that you never followed the sounds, because they don't like intruders coming too close to their homes. If you do get too close, they will cast a spell that disorientates a person and make them lose their way. If they do manage to make it back to their own community, they will live in a dazed state for the rest of their lives. That's quite creepy.
It does sound very fairy-like, though.
It does. The legend also says that if you find something in the forest, like a knife or some other small object, you should always ask the little people if you can have it. If you don't, they will throw rocks at you all the way back to your home. When the little people cry, their tears turn into cross-shaped stones. They do sound a lot like fairies.
They really do.
Examples of these stones really exist in Appalachia. They're often called fairy stones and are formed out of staurolite, a mineral full of iron and aluminum. They are made up of hexagonal crystals that intersect at right angles, so they appear cross-shaped. The little people were said to be small, and since the Moon Eye People statue stands at just 3 feet tall, it makes sense that the stone carving is meant to represent a pair of little people. Now, whether the statue is connected to Ford Mountain or any of the other ancient stone structures in the Appalachians, for that matter, is also up for debate. They could be totally unrelated. But it definitely makes for an interesting story and, as of yet, an unsolved mystery.
That's very cool. So it's interesting.
Well, that's why I love what we do, because we learn so much.
Yeah, and we hope that our listeners, you all are learning something too. And that's why you continue to listen to us, because we try to find things that people may not have heard before.
And you know what I like? I love the stories, but I love the theories about these so much more. The theories out there are just incredible.
Yeah. And some make more sense than others, of course.
Yeah.
But just to hear all the different points of view of what something could possibly be.
I mean, some are pretty outlandish to me, I gotta admit. But then again, maybe some of the things I think are outlandish to them.
I have it on good authority.
What do you mean?
Quite a few of the things you think might be a little outlandish to others.
Or maybe I'm ahead of my time.
Maybe. Or you just like playing devil's advocate.
Well, I do like doing that.
Yes.
Well, Beth, I think that about wraps it up for this episode.
I think so. And as always, you know my spiel by now, but if you would like to know more, you can always check our sources in our show notes. And as we mentioned, we didn't go into the alien theories about Moon Eye people, so you could always jump down that rabbit hole and we'll see you in 4 or 5 hours.
Right, or maybe it's something that we'll do in a upcoming episode.
Yeah, as like a follow-up or as a part two, but
exactly.
Not really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, join us next week for an all-new episode of Where Our Minds Wander.
See you soon.